On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Biochemical Reactors for Treating Mining-Influenced Water. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Biochemical Reactors for Treating Mining-Influenced Water team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Biochemical Reactors for Treating Mining-Influenced Water. We're going to introduce you to this document throughout the training class, and we do hope that it's a resource that you'll use after the training. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We're planning for today's class to be 2.25 hours. We are recording today's training, and we offer archives of past ITRC classes. During the class, the trainers are going to control the slides. If you would like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation. You start, go back to that CLUIN training page where we started today. We do look for your questions and feedback throughout today's training. In the bottom right, we have a Q&A box. You're welcome to type in questions or comments at any time. At the question and answer breaks, if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to unmute the phone so that you can ask questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do ask that you fill out our feedback form. We really do use that information, and we appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. A new feature that we offer is if you do complete the feedback form after the training class, you can check the box at the end. And that's going to allow you to get a confirmation email and a certificate of participation, so a new thing that we're offering. So that is after the end of the training class, and that's filling out the feedback form. If you do need to leave before we wrap up, you can access that feedback form on the middle right in the related URLs. You may need to scroll down to see that option, but once you select the feedback form, look down a bit and select Browse To, that's going to allow you to open the feedback form for today's class. ITRC's training is made up of people from various environmental sectors, and we have a poll here to ask you, what is your organization type? The team that developed this Biochemical Reactors for Treating Mining-Influenced Water team was led by state government, and they included members from state government, private sector, the federal government, as well as academia and public tribal stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included on the ITRC website and in the notes section of the slide. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We offer a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We have training archives from past classes, and we are working on our schedule for 2016 and hope to have that available soon. There's also the opportunity to become more involved in ITRC, so I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website. Looking at our poll results, you can see that our audience here today is somewhat similar to the ITRC team that developed today's training. We include members from state government, and the greatest majority are people from the private sector. So thank you for filling out the poll question. We'll have a few polls throughout today's training class. I'll now introduce our trainers for today. All of the trainers were members of the ITRC Biochemical Reactors for Mining-Influenced Water team. That team was led by Sherry Basinger from Missouri and David Cates from Oklahoma. Sherry Basinger is our first trainer today. She's the administrator for the Section of Epidemiology for Public Health Practices with the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services in Jefferson City. She spent most of her career working on mining waste sites, including Missouri's current and historic lead mine sites. Paul Eager is a volunteer with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in St. Paul. He specializes in passive treatment of mining-influenced water, waste management, reclamation, and regulatory issues. Eduardo Gosco is a senior environmental engineer with Burns & McDonald's Engineering in Chicago, Illinois. He has over 23 years of experience as an environmental consultant and has been involved in characterization, design, and implementation of remediation systems at multiple industrial sites. Christine Brown is a hazardous substance engineer at the California Department of Toxic Substances Control in Cypress. She reviews work plans and reports on remedial technologies. On slide 6, I'll now turn the presentation over to Sherry Basinger at the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services. Sherry?
Thank you, Juliana. I'm just checking to make sure that my mute is for real off.
Yes, you sound great.
Excellent. Thank you. So, first thing I'd like to cover is our learning objectives for today. At the end of today's about two and a half hour long training, you should be able to basically describe what a biochemical reactor is and how it works. You should have a general understanding of how you would figure out that a biochemical reactor may be applicable for use at your particular site. You should be able to navigate through the ITRC guidance document on biochemical reactors, and you should understand how you can use the ITRC guidance as a framework for making decisions. So how we're going to cover all that stuff today, our outline, basically I'll spend about the next 20 minutes talking about basics of biochemical reactors, then I'm going to turn it over to Paul Eager. He'll talk a little bit about determining when it's appropriate to use a biochemical reactor, when it's not. And then we'll talk about designing and implementing a biochemical reactor and some of the challenges that you may come across in implementing a biochemical reactor, along with some potential solutions for some of those challenges. Then we'll wrap up for the day. Now, the mining influenced water, because of the metal content and the pH, can create some pretty negative environmental effects. Those effects can range anywhere from decreasing bioavailability within a receiving body of water, a stream, or a lake, to completely killing all the aquatic life, as was the case in this particular stream, which is located in western Pennsylvania. You can see where the mining-influenced water is entering the stream right here by the discoloration in the substrate. But pretty much from this point, 32 miles downstream, there's no aquatic life in that stream whatsoever. It's pretty much just a dead stream. So obviously you've had an ecological loss there. You've lost 32 miles of stream, but you've also got a loss to the community because that stream is not going to be used for fishing. It's not going to be used for canoeing or any other recreational use. And then on top of the community loss and the ecological loss, you've got liability for the mine owners. Now, some mining areas or some mining-influenced water is located in populated areas. I keep saying popular for some reason. Some of them are popular. Most of them are not. But some of our mining-influenced water sites are located in populated areas, and there are some issues related to remediating those sites in the populated areas. But when you get out into the remote areas where you don't have access or infrastructure, those issues in implementing a remediation really can double up on you. Now, in 2010, ITRC put out a guidance document called Mining Waste Technology Selection Guidance Document. And what that guidance has is a series of decision trees where you answer some questions and the guidance provides you with a list of technologies that may be applicable for you to use in remediating your particular site. One of those technologies that's mentioned in that guidance document is a biochemical reactor. So if you were to take a site that had mining influenced water and also which affected either ecological or human health, and the site was located either in a remote location or there was a lack of infrastructure or the location was difficult to access for any of a variety of reasons, one of the technologies that would be selected or that the guidance document would suggest for you is a biochemical reactor. So, and then after that, after you go through the decision trees, there's a brief technology overview that talks about biochemical reactors. The guidance that we'll be talking about today goes into much more detail than the technology overview and the mine waste technology selection guidance. So the biochemical reactor that's present on this slide, the photo, is the Coal Pit Run biochemical reactor, which is located in western Pennsylvania. Now, what exactly is a biochemical reactor? Well, a biochemical reactor is an engineered treatment system that uses an organic substrate to drive microbial and chemical reactions to reduce the concentration of metals, acidity, and sulfate in mining-influenced water. And the photo on this slide is the Penn Hill No. 2 biochemical reactor, also located in western Pennsylvania. Now, just to kind of illustrate when you might want to use a biochemical reactor versus when you might not want to use a biochemical reactor, we've selected two mining sites. Both are located in Shasta County, California, a few miles apart as the crow flies. There's the Iron Mountain Mine and the Galinsky Mine. Now, the Iron Mountain Mine is a mine that is pouring out quite a bit of mining influence water, extremely low pH. It's in an area where you can access it, so we've got a big piece of real estate that's available, and given the water quality, given the proximity to infrastructure, to roads, to power, to water, this decision that was made in picking a remedial, remedial technology was that in this particular case, a traditional lime treatment plant and sludge disposal unit is probably the better option. We've got a way to get to it. There's lots of land that can be used to set up that traditional treatment system. People can get in and out of it on a regular basis to operate the system. On the other hand, the Galinsky Mine is located on the opposite shore of Lake Shasta, where there really isn't access to the site. There really isn't any infrastructure. There really isn't any way to get hold of it. So a biochemical reactor was a much better choice in this particular situation. They could take the mining influence water, pipe it down from the added into the nearest sort of level spot where they could create the biochemical reactor. Water could flow into the biochemical reactor, be treated, and then be released into Lake Shasta. Now, biochemical reactors can be used in a variety of situations. Mining influence water can be formed both in hard rock and in coal mining areas. And the Penn biochemical reactor, which is the top photo up here on the slide, is a coal mining area located in western Pennsylvania, whereas the Mammoth Mine, the other photo on the slide, is a hard rock mine located in Northern California. Biochemical reactors can be used in remote sites. While some of our mining areas are located in populated areas or near towns or near cities, most of them are out in remote areas. While the mines were operating in these remote areas, there were ways to access the area, but once the mining ceased, they quit maintaining the access. So that means that many of our areas that have mining influence water are difficult to access. They may not have power, they may not have other infrastructure, or there could be seasonal issues like a lot of snow in the winter or a lot of extreme heat in the summer, like in southern Arizona. Now, biochemical reactors can handle a variety of water quality. They, in terms of pH, they can treat water that's acidic, that's basic, or that's circumneutral. They can reduce concentrations of sulfate, metals like iron or copper, and metalloids like arsenic. Now, how does a biochemical reactor work? Well, along the lines of Father Guido Sarducci's, anything that you really need to know in life, you can learn in 5 minutes. I'm going to do a 5-minute intro to how a biochemical reactor works. First, what does a biochemical reactor do? Basically, it uses microbes and an organic substrate to precipitate out metals and metalloids. Then the pH is adjusted to produce circumneutral water. And the photo here, you can see the reddish iron precipitate at the interface between the free water and the substrate in the Galinsky Mine in Northern California. How does a biochemical reactor do that? Well, the microbes that we use in a biochemical reactor are sulfate-reducing bacteria. Sulfate-reducing bacteria are extremely common in soil worldwide. On the other hand, if you want to find the mother lode of sulfate-reducing bacteria, manure is the place to look. Manure is a fabulous source of sulfate-reducing bacteria. And fortunately for us, just about anywhere you're going to live in the world, there is some source of manure available. Now, sulfate-reducing bacteria remove sulfates by reducing them to sulfides, which then precipitate out of the water column. And in order for this reaction to occur, you've got to create that anaerobic environment that sulfate-reducing bacteria prefer. In a biochemical reactor, that we create that anaerobic environment by the degradation of the organic substrate. And then once you've got the bacteria, you've got the environment that they like, all you need is sulfate. And fortunately for us, mining influence water generally has lots of sulfate and an electron donor, which comes from the manure that we use in, or some sort of organic compound that we use in the substrate in the biochemical reactor. Now, in a bit more detail, the sulfate in the mining influence water reacts with the organic carbon in the substrate to produce hydrogen sulfide and bicarbonate. So this is that first set of equations right here. And then the hydrogen sulfide reacts with the metal to form a metal sulfide, which is generally insoluble, and they generally precipitate out, and hydrogen ions. Now, if you have more sulfate reduction, then you've got metals. That sulfate reduction is going to proceed in excess, and that's going to produce alkalinity. Generally, we also add limestone into the substrate in a biochemical reactor. So the degradation of that limestone with the hydrogen from the with the hydrogen from the previous equation is going to help also add alkalinity to the system. So that alkalinity then is going to produce a circumneutral water. But the one thing that you need to keep in mind is that if you don't have enough metal, that sulfate, the hydrogen sulfide, can be lost as a gas. So in addition to that being a stinky nuisance, it really could be a health and safety issue under some situations. So you need to keep that in mind in planning a biochemical reactor. There are several different designs for biochemical reactors that can be used, and that's going to be based on the topography and the situation that you've got at your particular site. All biochemical reactors have some way to bring water in, distribute it through the system, allow it to move through an anoxic reaction zone, and then discharge the water. So biochemical reactors can be created as a downflow biochemical reactor, where you would have water entering the system from the top. It's going to move across the system, move down through the anoxic reaction zone, and then be discharged through the bottom of the system. We can design it as an upflow biochemical reactor, where you have water coming in through the bottom of the system, being distributed through the system, moving up through the anoxic reaction zone to be discharged from the top of the system. Or you can design it as a horizontal flow biochemical reactor, where you have water moving through the anoxic reaction zone and then being discharged all in a horizontal manner. What are the advantages to using a biochemical reactor? Once you've got it installed, it doesn't really need a whole lot of help from the outside to run. You're using natural processes, you're using gravity, and it just kind of goes on its own. Biochemical reactors can be very low maintenance. They cannot be no maintenance. It's not a no maintenance system, but it can be a very low maintenance system if it's designed properly. And while it might look like it's kind of expensive from the beginning, the construction cost can be expensive, but then the operations and maintenance costs associated with running the system are going to be much lower. Biochemical reactors can be used in remote situations. They don't require a lot of outside power, a lot of outside water once they get going, and they do remove metals from water. Biochemical reactors are pretty flexible and pretty versatile. You can use it as a standalone system, like the Galinsky mine, where you just have a biochemical reactor. Or later on in the presentation, we'll show you a situation where a biochemical reactor is one of a series of treatments that are used as a treatment train. Biochemical reactors will treat a wide variety of mining influence water. They can handle acidic water, basic water, circumneutral water. But whatever, because they do remove the metals and they do remove the sulfide from mining influence water, they will improve the ecological functioning of the receiving body of water or the receiving stream. Now, anytime you have advantages, you're going to have some cautions. And probably the biggest caution is that biochemical reactors may not consistently meet stringent water quality standards. So that's one of those things that you're going to have to plan for and prepare and make sure everybody's on board with. While biochemical reactors are low maintenance systems, they are not walk-away systems. So you're going to have to do some monitoring and some maintenance on the system, and you just have to plan for that again. But it's going to be substantially less than a much more active treatment.
And so, my fellow environmental professionals, ask not what VSDR can do for you. Ask what this guidance can explain for your site.
So what this guidance document can do for you, first of all, it can help you decide if a biochemical reactor is an appropriate technology to use in your particular site. Then once you've made that decision, The guidance document can help support you pretty much throughout the system of planning. You know, it's going to help you in planning a biochemical reactor. It's going to talk about testing that may need to be done beforehand or afterwards. It's going to talk about monitoring the system. It's going to talk about what kind of support the system may need for operations, and it's also going to talk a little bit about maintenance. And much the thing that makes Paul the happiest about the whole guidance document is that we've got examples, we've got case studies where biochemical reactors have been used in the real world. And we've got 17 different case studies located throughout the U.S. and a couple of them in Europe. Those are all situations where biochemical reactors have been used, and we talk a little bit about the situation surrounding the biochemical reactor. One of the case studies is the Lady Leith Mine, which is located in Jefferson County, Montana. The Lady Leith Mine was located in an extremely remote part of the Deer Lodge National Forest in Jefferson County, Montana. The biochemical reactor was designed to remove iron and zinc from the mining influence water that was collected from the additive mine. It consists of a single sulfate-reducing biochemical reactor, which is fed from the bottom, so it's an upflow biochemical reactor. And the photos on the slide, first of all, you can see the adit up here. There's kind of a collapsed adit right here, and you can see the mining influence water coming out of the adit. You can tell it's mining influence water and has a lot of iron by that lovely orange color. Second photo shows construction of the biochemical reactor. Again, the mine adit is up here. Water would come down into the system, move through it, and then be discharged to this creek right here. This is a photo of, the third photo on the slide is the completed biochemical reactor. This shows the biochemical reactor adit is up here. The receiving stream is down here. And the final photo on the slide shows the receiving stream, and as you can see, it doesn't have this fabulous orange color. So then we've also got a little bit about, you can see the iron concentration got reduced by about half, and the sulfate concentration got reduced somewhat also. Now, just kind of to summarize all that up, biochemical reactors are a viable alternative for treating mining influence water, even in, or especially in, remote areas. The design of the biochemical reactor is going to be site-specific. Biochemical reactors are not going to be walk-away systems. They will require some maintenance. They will require some monitoring. And the ITRC guidance document on biochemical reactors is a convenient resource that you can use when considering using a biochemical reactor. And then at this point, I believe I am going to turn it over to Paul Eager, who's going to talk about determining when a biochemical reactor may be an appropriate technology to use. Paul?
Thanks, Sherry. So since I tend to be volume challenged, I'll ask how this sounds right now before we start.
You're okay. If you can just talk as loud as you can and as directly into the speaker, that's the best.
Okay, I will do that. And if, you know, again, if I do start to drift off, please send a message to Juliana and she'll hit me and tell me I should speak louder. All right, so as Sherry mentioned, we're going to talk a little bit about how you make a determination as to whether a biochemical reactor will work at your site. So what Juliana has mentioned and what we've included in the guidance document is this decision tree or flow chart. And what we're going to do is we're going to walk through this. And again, the reason we put this in and we put it up front in the document was so that you could go to the document, go through this decision tree relatively quickly, and decide whether it was worth spending more time going through the guidance or whether you needed to look for another technology. Okay, so the way this is set up and the way we'll walk through this is I've reached the age where I need geyser font, so I can't see that little tree unless I blow it up. So what we have over here is we essentially have on the left-hand side, we have kind of the portion of the tree we'll discuss, the exact box in the tree is highlighted in this green, and over on the right-hand side you can see the entire tree, and again there's that same highlight, so you can kind of see where we are in the progression as we move through. All right, so the first thing you need to do, and you need to do this no matter what kind of treatment technology you use, thinking about is characterize the influence. You know, what's your water quality? What's your flow? And, you know, again, for this kind of quick and dirty, when you're trying to say, well, is this even in the ballpark? You know, you could have average flows and average water chemistry. You know, as and we'll talk later, that that's not going to be enough when you really start thinking about design. The next thing you need to do is, what are your treatment goals? And this usually involves a conversation, hopefully with your friendly local regulator. And I worked in the public sector for a very long time, and this is one of the nicer things people refer to me as. So let's go down to the next box then. Is this is kind of the critical question, and Sherry kind of talked about the things that can be treated in a biochemical reactor, but can the specific contaminants of concerns, or COCs, be treated in a biochemical reactor? Because if it doesn't, you might as well go look someplace else. So to make this a little bit easier for people like me to look quickly at and see all these nice blue zones, so anything that's in a blue zone or a blue highlight can be treated in a BCR. And this is something that we modified from my friend and colleague, Jim Gusick. He was part of the team, and he provided this. Originally was set up for passive treatments. It was a periodic table of passive treatment. But we've, again, adapted it just for those elements that are treatable in a biochemical reactor. All right, so what happens if you are not in the blue zone? Well, we're from the government, and we're here to help you. So we did our first guidance document was the mine waste treatment technology selection, and that's the connection to our website there. And that basically discusses a variety of different types of technologies that would be applicable to different types of mine waters. So again, if the BCR isn't right, just go to our other guidance document, and hopefully you'll find some things that are workable for that as well. All right, so the next thing you need to do is calculate the loading. How many pounds per day if you live in the United States, or how many kilograms per day if you live anywhere else in the world? And that's, you know, I'm an engineer, so I love these kinds of calculations. And it's, there we are. All right. It is just the concentration in milligrams per liter times your daily flow in liters per day. That gives you your mass coming into your system. All right, what about pre-treatment or post-treatment? So, you know, the BCR is a wonderful passive treatment technology, but unfortunately, like many passive treatment technology, it is not the be-all and end-all. And often these things work better in some kind of combination. And so what's shown here in the photo is, I think this is one Sherry referred to in her introduction. This is a system. This is one of our wonderful case studies. And this is from Oklahoma. This is Mare Ranch or Tar Creek area, which is one of those big mining Superfund sites. And what we have here is we essentially have a series of cells. And, I'm arrow challenged too. There we go. So what happens is the water comes in, and you see that lovely orange-red color that Sherry showed you before. This is an oxidation pond. Most of the iron comes out in this first cell. This is surface flow wetlands. You can see they're also nice. They have some nice orange hues in those. And then you finally get to this third cell, and this is the biochemical reactor. So biochemical reactors will take out iron and aluminum, but they need to be much bigger than this particular cell. And so we can sometimes take out iron and aluminum more efficiently in a pretreatment system. Excuse me. And that reduces the size of the biochemical reactor. So this is now primarily designed to treat zinc, cadmium, and some lead. That's the residual after they get out the iron and aluminum. And then there's some additional polishing cells after that. So essentially, this reduces the size of the biochemical reactor and can prevent, you know, other types of problems, I think, that Eduardo will talk about in maintenance operation and monitoring. All right, so you've now decided whether you need pretreatment or not, and now you come up to, okay, I've got to estimate the size of the VCR. So what we recommend for this, there's more elaborate information in the guidance document. We'll talk about that in the next section. But again, for this kind of the initial look at this technology, there's a very nice program from our friends at the Office of Surface Mining, and this is that AMD TREAT. And it's free online. It has a series of different technologies. One of the modules deals with biochemical reactors. So again, you can use that to give you your initial size estimate. All right, so you now have the size. What's your site look? Is there space available? Well, one of the downsides of passive treatment technologies is that they tend to have a much larger footprint than the active treatment plant. So Sherry showed you kind of two different comparisons in two sites of California, but the mine drainage coming out of that first site with that big active treatment plant would have taken a very, very, very large area. So you have to look at that when you're thinking about passive technologies. You have to have land so you can build a treatment system that will be effective. So if you have the space, but is it necessarily level? So again, many of these abandoned sites where we're looking at using this technology are in mountainous terrain. And there's not a lot of level space. And that one photo of the Galinsky bioreactor, that's not a very big bioreactor, but they had to bring that water over a mile, in a pipeline to find that little bit of level space so they could actually build it. Is there substrate available? We'll talk more about substrate in a few slides. Again, we've been able to use substrates that are commonly available near your site. And so this is usually not any kind of restriction. Public concerns. Okay, Sherry also talked about this. VCRs are odor challenged, and some people find this smell very offensive. Those of us who work with this technology always say that's the smell of success. Some of you who live near industrial sites probably have heard people say that's the smell of money. But obviously, if you're living close to it, it's not very pleasant. And as Sherry mentioned, in some situations when we have these, we have to be careful, particularly when we're in monitoring buildings where you might be sampling and that H2S gas can accumulate. So again, this is something that luckily most of our sites are remote, and a little bit of odor is not usually a big problem. What about costs? This is always the big issue. Again, the OSM program, AMD TREAT, does provide some cost estimates. What we found in practice is that those are a little bit optimistic, that the costs are usually roughly maybe half of what they turn out to be. But again, it gives you some guidelines as to how much might this technology cost for your site. Well, hopefully then you've gotten through the decision tree and decided, hey, this is the best thing since sliced bread and it would work for my site. So hopefully that's where you are, and that means you're going to want to read the rest of the guidance document and not hang up on me and as we go forward and talk a little bit more about specifics. All right, so again, this is where we are in the outline. We're now going to start talking about how you actually design and build one of these things, and the first thing you have to do is you have to do some testing. Again, so far everything has been theory. In theory, it should work. That's what the flow chart, the decision tree tells you. So this is kind of where the proverbial rubber meets the road, and we actually start testing. So what do we need to do treatability testing? And again, do treatability testing no matter what kind of technologies you're going to use. You obviously need representative water quality, a representative sample of your water, mine influence water, as we use that euphemism now. And then a substrate. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we've been able to use, you know, substrates that are locally available, and these are three of the commonly used ones, and we'll talk about why we use these in a few slides. All right, let's talk about substrate. So I wish I could tell you that I have the designer substrate, and I can sell it to you at a very reasonable cost. Unfortunately, that's not true, because there is no silver bullet substrate, and, you know, I don't have that market yet, so I keep looking for it. But what we found that, you know, there's a variety of functions that we want this substrate to serve and provide. And first thing is, well, we've got to provide carbon, because, I mean, Sherry did kind of throw up that equation that you obviously need carbon, you need sulfate. And what the bacteria need is they need short chain carbons. And so, but we want them to have basically carbon or food initially, that short-term carbon to get started. And then we obviously want to have carbon available long-term too. So we need kind of a long-term source of carbon. So that we need, that's kind of part of the food source. The other, as Sherry mentioned, is sulfate, which we have an abundance of that in mine water if we have mine water issues. So the next thing we need then is some kind of source of microbial inoculum. Sherry mentioned the mother load of sulfate-reducing bacteria is manure. Some source of alkalinity, because we want to provide some additional buffering capacity to our media. Because even though, as Sherry discussed, when you have sulfate reduction, if that occurs in excess, you get excess alkalinity. But you always want to have an inorganic source of alkalinity as well to make sure that you can maintain the pH in your reactor. In the early days when we did this without sources of alkalinity, we had, as we used to say, fermenters gone wild. So this very complex carbon, it requires fermenting bacteria to break that down to the small chains that the sulfate-reducing bacteria can use. When they get going, they will produce acid conditions. Obviously, you need good permeability. We want water to flow through this substrate. You know, again, that's one of the reasons we use this mixture to provide all these different components. We obviously need microbial attachment sites and locally available material. So this is essentially, we have the functions here on the left, and then we have kind of the material that can provide that function on the right. And so again, what we do, this is kind of the typical materials that have been used in the past. What's commonly used now for long-term carbon, it tends to be wood chips. For short-term carbon, it tends to be hay, because these are pretty available most places. We tend to use some kind of manure for the inoculum. Limestone is typically used for the alkalinity. And again, since we're using wood chips, we usually have sufficient permeability. So again, that's kind of the way we do this. But again, we're always looking for local materials that might be available. Maybe it's a waste product that we can provide, you know, some of these functions with that material. All right, so we've got our water, we have some materials we want to test as substrates. Let's go into the lab and do some testing. And so this is kind of the first laboratory screening test that one might do, and it's called a proof of principle. And you can see that in the lower right, there is essentially a whole bunch of little serum bottles. And this is pretty common. You would just set this up. It's a short-term test. You might use a variety of different substrates in these bottles. And you basically say, okay, can I get reducing conditions? Do I get pH coming up? Is this sulfate reduction actually working for my water? Now we don't do this anymore. We did this a lot when the technology was first in its infancy. But you know, we've been doing this for a while now, and we have a pretty good idea of what types of waters we can treat, what kind of substrates work well. Where we might want to do this and is when you have maybe either some water quality that's unusual, or maybe you have some locally available organic waste product that you want to use. So recently I've been discussing using a biochemical reactor with a friend and colleague on an industrial facility, and it's a dye plant, and they have some organic residue, and it's like, well, maybe we could use that as part of the substrate mixture. If we get to that point, we would want to do some kind of proof of principle to make sure that material can break down, and B, that there's no toxic properties with it. What we do more commonly is we essentially go to what we call the bench test. This is typically done in the field. It's typically done in 55-gallon drums. It's not, you don't need that container, but that's kind of what we've always used. Some of us who've been around for a while refer to these as Daryl's barrels, because the first one to use this was a person named Daryl that worked for the former U.S. Bureau of Mines. And so that's how we got that nickname. But they work very well. They're very commonly available. You get a good amount of substrate. You can apply a decent amount of water and get some pretty good results. So what we're doing here is we do this on site so we can use actual site water. We're evaluating our media. We're looking at what kind of residence time is needed to treat the water, how fast or how many pounds per day can we actually load into this system. And we can do some pre and post treatment if we need it. And the other thing this allows us to do is another euphemism for other parameters. This is sometimes called nuisance parameters. And one of the disadvantages of the technology is you've got water sitting in a bunch of organic material. You know, most of us are either coffee or tea drinkers. You put organic material in water and you get color. That's exactly one of the things you get out of this water. The initial water particularly is quite brown. It has high levels of nutrients. It has a fairly substantial biochemical oxygen demand. And so that's why you need to look at post-treatment to deal with some of those parameters, and that depends on your specific site. Again, in the early days when this technology was developing, we were using it on some of those streams that Sherry showed, where there was no life for 32 miles. A little bit of organic material going into the stream at the beginning of the setup was not a big deal. What you're trying to do is decrease the acidity, increase the pH, and return aquatic life. If you're looking at this for a permitted site, some brown water with high BOD going into a stream is a very big deal. So again, it depends on your site, but again, that's something that you really do need to consider. And I have actually I've updated a presentation that I've not been very good about distributing yet, but it talks a little bit about some of the lessons learned, and we're hoping to maybe incorporate that later on in some additional trainings. So again, hopefully your bench tests have gone well, and this looks like it's going to work, and now it's like, all right, let's go to a bigger scale so we can actually get our design information and we can build a full-scale system. And so this is the pilot test. This, again, is done on-site. You want to be in the environment that you're going to build this system. You want to use that mine water. You want to look at operating conditions and changes in water quality over time. And that's a minimum of 1 year. You know, I'm an engineer. We never have enough data. But 1 year is our minimum. We prefer 2 or 3. Again, that allows you to look at, you know, the change in time, change in seasonal performance, and the other parameters. And what we see with those other parameters is typically in within 3 to 6 months, that flush of nuisance parameters is gone. So again, that provides you better data for your scale up on your timing that you may need that post-treatment. All right, so we've done our testing. Now you've got your great data from your pilot test, and you're ready to go and really design one that you're going to build. All right, so I always show this slide because I really like it, because it always reminds me that this is really important. Some of you who've been around for a while may recognize this as the politically correct version of the 7 P's. But again, particularly with any system, this is true, but particularly with passive treatments, because, you know, passive treatment technology over time, it's a very effective technology if it is designed and implemented correctly. People sometimes have bad feelings about this technology because they've heard someplace where it wasn't successful, and it's basically because there wasn't a good plan and there wasn't a good implementation. All right, I'll get down off of that soapbox and we'll talk about what we need to do design. Obviously now, we really need detailed information. So before, when we were talking about the flow chart, you know, average concentrations were good enough. Now, you really need to look at averages and extremes. Not only what you have existing, but given the fact that climate change is real, things are going to change, and you need to kind of think about that. You really need a good detailed map of your site, including all your elevations. Again, what makes passive treatment work and makes it attractive is the fact that we can design these systems so they are low maintenance, and that means gravity flow. And so you've got to have that elevation difference to feed the drive the systems. Again, your climate, as I mentioned, you know, not only what it is, but what it might become. Treatment goals, again, are very important, and obviously this whole question of pre- and post-treatment. Again, all this, hopefully, you've developed, you know, while you're doing your pilot test, and you have that information available. And this is some of the other additional information you would have gathered through your pilot test. As I mentioned, the seasonal variability. It's a microbial process. Microbes like warm weather. They don't like living in Minnesota in the winter, so where some of us live. But so you have to know that. There is going to be some variability in the function of your systems, depending on how it's built and where it's located. You know, what loading range can your system handle? Can it handle, you know, some disturbances in that loading range so you can make sure that the system will continue to work? What's the residence time? And what's your substrate mixture going to be? Degradation rate and metal removal efficiency are things that you have collected during your pilot test. All right, so what size do you really need? Again, we kind of got some preliminary estimates when we used AMD Treat. Now you have actual site-specific data. You can take that and figure out the size of your system. And so what this is, it's a balance. It's a balancing process. It's a mass balance, basically. Again, that's why this whole loading concept and the mass is so important. So what we're looking at on one side is how much sulfate reduction can we get on our site with our climate, with our water, with our substrate. And what we do is we determine a volumetric rate, millimoles per cubic meters per day. So that's what occurs in a unit volume. This is our total volume. That gives us our total amount of sulfate reduction. That's the amount of sulfate reduction. How much that sulfate reduction needs to balance the amount of metals coming in. You know, again, if we don't have enough sulfate reduction to treat this load, the water will not be fully treated. And so this contaminant load is the sum of all the contaminants in millimoles per day, and that includes your divalent, trivalent metals and your proton acidity. So when you add those up, you have your total acidity. All right, well, I had a one equation limit, and this is it. It's explained in more detail in the guidance document, but this is how you calculate that total acidity load. And so you have, you based on your water quality, you know the concentrations of all these parameters. That's your total acidity of millimoles per day. From your pilot test, you have the sulfate reduction rate, millimoles per cubic meters per day for your specific site, for your specific water. You divide those, you get the volume of your reactor. So that's what you need. Okay. Then the big question is, okay, does it fit? Well, we can adjust the design someplace because volume is equal to the area, the depth times the depth. So, you know, if you don't have enough area, you can maybe make it a little bit deeper. So typically, these systems are about a meter, 3 to 4 feet deep, roughly. The maximum one that I know of is about 6 feet. Again, since I've never seen a case study I didn't like, I always ask, if there's anyone in the training today who knows something that's deeper, I'd like to know. Or if anyone who wants to try one deeper, let me know. I'm always interested in that too. You know, there's no inherent reason why it couldn't be deeper. Originally, we were concerned that before we started to use a lot of wood chips, we were really concerned that if we had too much depth, we might start to get compaction of substrates. Some of the early substrates were mushroom compost. It's a very good substrate, but it doesn't have a whole lot of permeability. And so that became kind of a rule of thumb. You know, now with the wood chips, they're pretty permeable. Greater than 6 feet, you know, might be very doable. So, but again, so what's your other option? You know, you really don't have a great, you're not sure you have the area and the depth to actually do kind of this substrate-based. Again, we have an alternative, and that's the infamous bugs on booths. That's what we're doing then is rather than providing the carbon in a solid form using, you know, our mixtures of materials, we're applying it directly as a liquid. We're applying small chains such as ethanol or molasses. Sugar and booze, what could be better? How you get happy microbes. They can really go to town then. And what we've seen in some comparative lab tests is that, you know, giving them the sugar and booze alternative to the, you know, to the pile of manure and wood chips, these guys will work 3 to 10 times faster than they will on the solid. So you can dramatically decrease the size of your biochemical reactor. This photo in the lower right is a system that was built in northern Minnesota. It was a pilot. Essentially, it's a horizontal flow system. Water was flowing through a rock matrix. And we were providing a combination of ethanol and molasses in this yellow tank. And again, we got very good results in treating. This is a site that was designed to treat sulfate. All right, this is something that, again, that I really like, and this is flexibility. And if you've got the room and the budget, having parallel treatment trains is a really good idea. The system was designed so that either one could treat all the flow from the system. And so, you know, again, these are passive systems. They are low maintenance, not no maintenance. They periodically you need to do some maintenance. These do have a lifetime. You know, we'll talk about that in a few slides. At some point, you're going to need to replace the substrate. And so by having a parallel system like this, you know, you could, say, do maintenance on the cell on the left, and all the water could be treated on the cell on the right. Or you could replace the media and still treat. Because the last thing you want to go to is talk to your regulator and say, well, you know, I got to do some maintenance. I'm going to have to bypass this awful water around my system. A, that would not be well received. And B, you spent all this time and money restoring this receiving stream, and you got to have something to do with this water when you have to do maintenance or replace that substrate. So again, I have lots of soapboxes. I'll get off that one too and talk a little bit about the guidance document and some more examples and some great equations in Appendix C. Also, the AMD tree has some very good background information and support documentation. All right, so I alluded to this, and this is the big question. You know, how long do these systems last? So we make some initial calculations, you know, based on your pilot results, your carbon consumption, you know, how much limestone you're dissolving if you have an acid situation, and the carbon consumption, you know, based on the breakdown of your organic matter, your sulfate reduction rates that are occurring. When you do that, you typically come up with about 20 to 30 years. Again, I'm fairly conservative from a scientific standpoint anyway. And we always like to have safety factors. And so my typical estimate is 10 to 20. You know, we're now getting to the point, I'm working right now on a system that was operating for 10 years. It had to be moved because they were expanding the mine. It was still functioning after 10 years. the Mare Ranch system, that is starting to approach 10 years. That's another one of our case studies. And I showed you that early on in the presentation. So the more we see systems getting this 10-year mark and doing well, we start, you know, saying, well, maybe these 20 to 30-year estimates are not so optimistic, that maybe those are more realistic. And so, again, but they do have finite life. The good news is they seem to be lasting longer than we were, than those of us who are conservative were willing to say initially. So that's the good news. And with that, I will turn it back over to Juliana for the first Q&A session.
Thank you, Paul. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using the Q&A box in the lower right. For our phone line participants, you are welcome to unmute your phone, and that is #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to ask questions out loud. As we're asking questions, we do have a poll question for our audience here on slide 58. So where are the mining-influenced water sites that you're working on? Where are those located? We have a couple questions that have come in through that question Q&A box. Is there a maximum loading rate where the BCR becomes too large and uneconomical compared to conventional lime treatment?
That's a very good question. Sherry showed Iron Mountain, which is, that's where that active treatment plant is located. Many of you probably have heard of that. That is the home of the negative pH. You know, I don't think that's pretty awful water. Again, you'd have to spread that water out in such a large area to try to get reasonable treatment. And so that's when you start really starting to look at, you know, kind of conventional active treatment technology. What we've looked at for some sites which have pretty horrendous water and really low pH, really high iron and aluminum, is what we call a hybrid system, where you might put in a semi-active lime doser. Again, these are well described in our first guidance document, but you know, a common one which people may be familiar with is called Aquafix. And what this is, it's a water wheel driven lime doser. And so you can have water coming through essentially your diverted stream, your stream of water runs the water wheel. The faster that water wheel spins, the more lime that drops out of the hopper. That drops into the stream, it dissolves quickly, it drops out the iron and aluminum in a downstream settling pond, and then that water can go to the VCR. And so that then greatly reduces the size of the VCR. It's not a passive system like the photo I showed you where with just an oxidation pond. You actually have to put in more maintenance. But again, it's a way of combining it. But in some waters, you know, sometimes it's just better to look at active treatment. A particular point is when you start looking at sulfate treatment. You know, here generally, you know, really bad water has, you know, 10 milligrams per liter of metals, 100 milligrams per liter. Really bad water for sulfate has over 1,000 milligrams per liter. And you've got to remove a lot of sulfate to get down to some of the guidelines. You know, I think not everyone is regulating sulfate. Some people are looking at 250 to 500 milligrams per liter. Here in Minnesota, where wild rice is a big issue, we are debating over what the sulfate standard should be. The one on the books right now is 10 milligrams per liter. And so when you start looking at trying to treat a lot of water to get that much, you know, sulfate out, it gets to be really big areas and gets to be really expensive. And we did one feasibility study where, you know, it just came up, it just was not economic to do a passive treatment system. So again, depends on your site, depends on your water quality, but it's certainly something you always want to consider.
Can you address issues with substrate clogging?
Well, that is a big concern. You know, I think with it was a bigger concern early on when a lot of our reactors were built with things like spent mushroom compost, or when we used the mother load of sulfate-reducing bacteria, cow manure. You know, that seemed like, well, that in the initial days, that seemed like a great idea. You know, cow manure, no one wants it. It's available. It's got great, you know, it's got a lot of organic material. You really, it breaks down quickly. But, you know, you ever try to flow water through it, it doesn't work very well. And so that's why a lot of the substrates have now migrated towards using something like, you know, wood chips. On the list in the guidance document, it talks about walnut shells, for example. You know, in our, you know, Bugs on Boo system, we used, you know, kind of a run of, we used some mine waste rock and it was crushed. So again, that is an issue. Again, there's been problems where there's been failures, where you have a lot of, you didn't pre-treat for iron, your system was a little bit too small, and you get a lot of iron buildup on top of your substrate. And so that's another clogging, or you can get aluminum in the systems. We visited a system as part of our guidance trip, a same trip of Pennsylvania where you saw where they had a very big system. It wasn't functioning. The thought was that it was due to the high concentration of aluminum that was accumulating within the bed. Would have probably been better handled with a pretreatment system. So it certainly is an issue. Again, it's a function of your water quality. The other thing that you want to make sure is that you do not have, that you're controlling your suspended solids loaded here. That's a very important pretreatment. If you do have water that could have a lot of suspended solids, you've got to keep that out of the reactor or it'll plug it. And if I don't answer your question, feel free to follow up.
Related to sizing, the millimole per meter cube per day approach is a linear relationship where a lot of reactions occur very fast initially, then tail off. How does the design process account for that?
That's another very good question, and that's why we like to have pilot tests run 2 to 3 years. You do what they call it luxury consumption. So if you run a very short-term test, like our bench tests are usually 3 to 6 months. You know, in the first, particularly in the first 3 months, you get very fast reaction because there's a lot of very readily available carbon and you can drive the reaction very quickly. So again, that's why we like that longer term, but then you can start seeing, you know, what is your long-term sulfate reduction rate. And so the longer you can run that pilot, the better handle you have on that. And again, part of the reason that we're starting to do, you know, some of the looking at these longer term systems is actually to start looking at, you know, how has sulfate reduction changed over time? Are those, how good is the predictions that were made? You know, how are they substantiated by the data long term?
Can this process be used for high sulfate saline oil field produced water?
That's probably where you'd want to do proof of principle testing. You know, sulfate reduction occurs in the ocean, so I don't think the saline would be an issue. It occurs in ocean sediments. So I don't think that's an issue. Again, it'll take out the sulfate. But I guess, you know, I'm not aware of people using this on those types of waters. But again, never wanting to turn down a case study or some good information. If you have some studies or anybody's done this, I would certainly be interested in knowing. Again, I think the sulfates, and I have not worked with these waters myself, you know, my understanding is that they're pretty brackish and concentrations are pretty high. And so again, depending on what your limit is, you might be able to treat it. But if you really need to reduce a lot of sulfate, you're going to be looking at a very large sulfate reduction area. The other issue here with sulfate treatment, and it was kind of alluded to in Sherry's slides, where she said, well, you have to have enough metals to tie up the sulfate. And if you don't, you get one heck of a lot of H2S, or you get a lot of sulfide going out of your effluent stream, which then later just, A, it's toxic to aquatic organisms, B, it'll oxidize the sulfate downstream, so you have to tie up that sulfate. And in waters like the pilot test that I showed you that was done in northern Minnesota, that was a sulfate issue. There was no metals to tie it up. What we were trying there was, it was an iron mine, it was iron-rich waste rock, and so we were trying to provide iron from the rock to tie up the sulfide that's generated. In some of these sites where you don't have that, you're either looking at trying to get in some kind of iron source, waste rock, tailings, and that often can be expensive and, kind of an issue, trying to make sure that you tie up the sulfate. So again, in these really brackish waters, it's not just getting rid of the sulfate, it's tying up that sulfide that you generate so you don't cause more problems or different problems.
We have a comment that has come in. The examples shown on the slides, they don't look anaerobic, are they?
That's because Sherry has all those nice pictures of that green stuff. So these are all obviously, the surface, it's obviously open to the atmosphere. That surface water is not anaerobic. But essentially the flow, and Sherry's cross-section, the water goes through the substrate. And so as soon as you get below the surface of substrate, you generate anaerobic conditions. And so it's the deeper zones that are actually doing the work. It's not that superficial pond layer. And we'll show you some pictures later where we don't have a superficial pond layer at all.
Do you have a general rule to calculate how much of the BCR is active due to high flow pathways and the effect of variable permeabilities?
Oh, I wish I had that answer. We are working on this autopsy, and we're certainly starting to see in the early phases of analyzing the data the sense that there is some preferential flow. There was also some work done in Pennsylvania, I think it was the Howe Bridge site, I believe, where they also showed some preferential flow. And so again, it's obviously something that happens. As we get more data on it, maybe we'll be able to say, well, maybe you should use a safety factor or you should increase your safety factor to account for preferential flow. So I think you have to be aware of that because it probably does occur. I mean, you'll see when we go into the construction and design, we do everything we can to try to minimize that, but, it's not a perfect system.
Are BCR systems used in conjunction with active treatment, liming, to achieve strict limits? Has this been successful?
They certainly can be, and I mentioned that's kind of what we would call a hybrid system. And, the hybrid could be an active plant, and you could then polish with a BCR. Because, problem with liming, liming works great. I mean, it is kind of the if you're looking for active treatment processes that everyone knows works, liming is it. But to get out some of the trace metal, you have to push the pH, up 9, 10. If you're trying to get manganese out chemically, then you're at 10 and 11. And then you have to kind of bring that pH back down. And so you could say, well, let's just treat a pH 5, 5.5, get out all the iron and aluminum, let the BCR take the trace metals. I don't know, I'm not aware of any site. Again, if someone has that information, I would really like to have that. Personally, I'm not aware of any sites that actually are doing that, say, with an active treatment initially, and then a polishing BCR. And passively, it's certainly something we've talked about and, you know, kind of kicked around, done some feasibility studies. But, again, I'm not sure if those have actually been implemented.
Thank you.
But, I mean, it's a good approach.
We have additional questions. Some of these I know we answer in the second half. So if we haven't responded to your question yet, keep listening. I know some of these we are going to address later in the presentation. We are out of time for this question and answer break. I'd like to thank our participants for filling out the poll questions. You can see the results that have come in all over the United States. We have some northern Canada as well. So thank you all for filling out the poll question. We'll continue on now with the second half of the training class, and I'm going to turn it back over to Paul Eager, who's the volunteer with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Paul?
Okay, thanks, Juliana. So again, since Juliana hasn't hit me, I assume that everyone can hear me. But again, if I start to wander off, just, you know, remind me. So this is where we're at in the outline. We're now going to talk about construction. And as you'll see when we get into this, many of you will have done constructions like this, at least for part of this. It's not much different. Many phases are very similar to any kind of line pond or landfill, capped landfill. But there are some distinct differences that are very important when you build biochemical reactors. And so this is our cross-section of what a BCR is going to look like. And what you'll see is that we'll basically discuss each of these different components and have a figure, a photo, to illustrate it. And so as you'll see, this one does not have, we're going to talk about, we're going to be talking about covered BCRs, and we'll talk about why we do that in a minute. So this is not going to look like many of the slides that Sherry showed, where we had this nice green vegetation and a nice pond. All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about is subgrade, because most of our systems, particularly if you're building at any kind of active site, you're looking at a liner. And so again, what you'll see is we'll have in the bottom left will be the cross-section with the component identified, and then in the right there'll be a photo of exactly what we're discussing. And hopefully that will be more clear. But they always say a photo is worth 1,000 words, and people say, Eager, when you talk, it's worth 10,000 words. So hopefully you'll get the picture from the picture. So again, the thing you need to do is you're going to put a liner down. You've got to have a good surface to place that liner. Generally, your liner installer wants to inspect this because he or she's not going to warranty that liner unless they know that they're placing it on a good subgrade. If you have sand available, if you have good material, you know, the standard classification requirement is 100% minus 3/8 inch material. So, you know, bedding sand is very nice if you have it. Most of us are not that lucky. And so what we do is we put down kind of a cushioning geotextile. Get out the big rocks, roll your area smooth, you put down your geotextile to protect your liner. And then this just happens to be a linear low-density polyethylene liner going in. The specific liner is going to depend on your design engineer, what he or she feels most comfortable with, what might be the most economic, what they have the most experience working with, and what your regulatory agency, again, has permitted in the past or feels comfortable with. But again, this is done typically by, you would hire a liner installer to put this in. Again, very similar to line ponds, line landfills. I didn't have a photo of the next phase, but you can kind of see this here. This essentially is the cushioning geotextile that goes on top of your liner before you put in your drainage collection system. All right, this is the finished drainage collection piping. Again, it's pretty standard. Series of lateral pipes and header pipes. And again, you know, being engineers, we go to great effort to lay this out to try, again, to minimize that preferential flow. Because, you know, the question was right. You know, if you get all your flow coming in here, your reactor's not going to be appropriately sized. So again, we do our best that we can to try to distribute water on the top and collect it on the bottom in a uniform manner. All right, then you have to put the gravel in over your piping. Ideally, you do this from the berm. This is just some ways. This is kind of an innovative way, using kind of a cement truck to kind of shoot it out. Again, more standard excavator, just kind of placing it and dragging it out. And you don't want to, again, the whole idea is to protect your liner from any kind of punctures. All right, this is where the big differences start to appear between your NIST standard, lined, and capped construction and BCRs. And this is mixing organic substrates. You can find lots of contractors who know how to build, you know, line facilities. Not very many have done this. And after they've done it, they may not want to do it again. But it is, it's an art, because you have to get a good blend. This is where it's critical that you have someone from your design team on site. You know, I know clients don't like to pay for consulting engineers on site, but it's really critical, because this is where if something's going to go wrong, this is likely where it's going to go wrong. You know, you may have had great substrate for your pilot. You order, inspect the same thing. You get a low bid. It's not the same material. You basically need someone who says, this isn't right. We either need different material, or we need to blend it differently, or we need to make sure it's blended. You need to make sure this material is also blended as uniformly as possible, which is difficult when you're dealing with, again, it's not a single substrate. You're using components to make a substrate. So, again, I can't emphasize the importance of having someone from your design team on site when this is being mixed and when it's being placed. Again, if you can load it from the exterior berms, that's great. Often you need to basically just kind of build a working ramp. Again, similar to if you were putting sand over a liner, this is the same way you do it. And you just kind of work off that using low ground pressure vehicles to distribute the material. And try to place it as uniformly as possible. All right, I think I mentioned earlier that when this technology first started, we used to use lots of manure. That gave us, again, great initial sulfate reduction, lousy BOD coming out of the water initially, and, again, not very good permeability. And what we've learned over time is that you don't need a whole lot of inoculum to really get that sulfate reduction system working. And so often what we do now is we just apply a little bit to the surface and disk it in. And so that's what's being done here. Again, you can see that we're jumping all over the country here in some of our photos. Again, some of our case studies do that, as Sherry showed you that map. All right, so again, there was the question about, well, these systems all look nice and green. They look like aerobic ponds. Those are in relatively mild climates like, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, and so, you know, California. And now you get to places like, you know, the north central part of the state or the country where some of us live. And this particular site, the average frost depth was 5 feet. This seep flowed year-round. We have to have year-round treatment. This is an active mining site. It was going to have to meet NPDES permit limits, so it had to work year-round. And so what's done here is you put in some type of low-weight fill. And what we were used here was wood chips. Decent insulating ability, readily available, particularly in the north-central part of the country where we have, you know, adequate forests and wood product industries. And then you line it, essentially keep, you know, snow melt and rain from coming into your BCR. The other place where you might want to line this is the other part of the climate spectrum. This is in the Southwest. Here it's not frost. Here it's evaporation. You don't want your substrate to dry out. You want to keep this water logged so you minimize your oxygen transport and you can maintain your anaerobic conditions. So this, again, as I mentioned, this is in the southwest. We're covering it here, again, just to reduce the evaporation. This is a very low flow in the summer. The water balance said, you know, we're going to lose more water through evaporation than we can feed this thing based on the flow from our seed, which tends to dry up in the summer. So you've got, you're putting in essentially a subsoil and a topsoil liner over it, a topsoil layer over it, so that we can get vegetation to grow. And that's what we're doing here. This is hydro seeding, and this essentially is what the finished product looks like. So again, it doesn't look like a nice pond. It just looks like a mound, but you've got anaerobic conditions underneath that, and you're getting sulfate reduction and effective treatment. All right, so I think this might be my last slide and my last soapbox speech. You know, we started to work on this training, we put it together, and someone said, you know, gosh, you know, this is a highly engineered system. These are really expensive. You know, a lot of our sites are small, and they're up in the middle of nowhere. Do we really need all this? And it really depends. You know, you still need the 6 P's or the 7 P's, depending on what you prefer. But you've got, the other thing you have to consider is, what is your goals? Are you at an active site? Do you have to meet NPDES standards year-round on a continuous basis? You know, can you allow water to infiltrate the ground at an active site? Probably not. You're probably going to have to contain all your water with a liner. If you're remote and you're looking at best management practice, you know, you're trying to return aquatic life to that 32-mile stretch of river, you know, it's not so important that you have a liner under this, as long as you have a decent soil layer that will maintain the water level, because the water infiltrating through the ground underneath your BCR is treated. So again, you know, you don't need necessarily all the bells and whistles if you're just trying to do a basement best management practice. In our guidance document, and I think Christine will talk a little bit about the Good Samaritan Law. There's now interest, again, on the national level has been reinvigorated since the problem with the Gold King spill in Colorado and the impact on the Animas River. People are starting to say, you know, we need to do something. We need to let watershed groups do work here, again, as a best management practice. And for many of us who work in this field, particularly in the passive treatment area, this is kind of one of our long-term goals, to get this type of technology implemented in some of these remote sites through watershed groups who are interested in it. Very active program in Pennsylvania, very successful. Pennsylvania has a very nice Good Samaritan Law. Lots of good work's been done there. So again, it's always site-specific. That's always, it's always true. I mean, some people always feel like engineers always hide behind that, but it's really very, very true. You know, it's the size and your setting. What are your goals? I think with that, I get off the soapbox, and I'll turn it over to Eduardo, who's going to talk about monitoring, operation, and maintenance.
Thanks, Paul. Before we get to Eduardo, we do have another quick poll question. In the next section of the training, we're going to talk about monitoring, operation, and maintenance. So as we're getting into that section from our audience, what parameters do you think we should monitor? So here's our chance for our audience to think ahead a little bit and think about the different things that you would monitor in a BCR. So as those answers are coming in, they are going to be displayed. We have so far BOD, ORP, alkalinity, total and dissolved metals. So thank you all for starting to think about that and fill out those poll results. pH is another one that has been listed here. We'll now continue on with the next section, and I'm going to turn it over to Eduardo Gasca at Burns & McDonald Engineering.
Thank you, Juliana. I just want to make sure that everybody can hear me.
We can. Thank you.
Okay. As stated, my name is Eduardo Gasca. I'm based in the Chicago area. And this part of the presentation discusses the monitoring, operation, and maintenance that BCRs normally have. Specifically, we will be presenting when where, what, and why we monitor, operate, and maintain VCRs. It's based on Section 6 of the ICRC Bioreactors Guidance. So, because they are often in remote locations and passive treatment systems, VCRs are inherently designed to have minimum operational efforts and low maintenance, with periodic monitoring conducted for performance evaluations as well as for compliance requirements. So there are three main types of monitoring to consider for VCRs. The first one is monitoring the physical condition of the system itself. The second one is operational performance monitoring for essentially water flows as well as the water chemistry. And the third one is monitoring the water chemistry for regulatory compliance. As Paul mentioned before in the VCR construction section, VCRs should be constructed with monitoring ports or locations that allow for the evaluation of the VCR's operation performance. Effluent monitoring is also performed to demonstrate that the VCRs, the effluent of the VCRs are meeting the applicable effluent quality criteria. Now, monitoring devices can include piezometers, monitoring wells, influent and effluent structures, and sampling ports, and outflow effluent monitoring streams. Although not as common, there are some instances where automated monitoring equipment can be used and include open channel flow measuring devices as well as automatic samplers that can be programmed to collect samples and perform some limited analysis. Now, most of the monitoring performed at the VCRs is to ensure that the design criteria such as flow and water chemistry and expected effluent are being met, and that the organic substrate consumption takes place as designed. So when is monitoring of VCRs necessary? That's the first question I need to answer. There are two specific phases of the life of the VCRs where monitoring is essential. The first one is during the initial startup of the VCRs, and the second is during the normal full flow operation. During the startup, the VCRs can be monitored more frequently to determine that the system is functioning as designed and to ensure that the sulfate-reducing bacteria and biomass growth is growing in the VCRs as expected. Now, during normal operation, VCRs are monitored for performance and for compliance purposes, that is at the effluent. At minimum, some seasonal monitoring would take place, maybe once to twice a year. Now, where VCRs are monitored? Essentially, we monitor at the influent, in the VCR itself, and at the effluent. Additional locations where monitoring can be necessary includes pre- and post-treatment units and at designated compliance points. Now, the picture in the slide shows actual monitoring of pH and conductivity that was performed as we were visiting one of the sites. So now, what do we monitor? The answer really depends on the specific operational phase of the VCR, as well as the regulatory requirements. There are two main types of monitoring, the performance monitoring and the monitoring for compliance. Now, to monitor for performance, One normally measures parameters that can be read in the field, such as pH, which is a measure of acidity of the water, temperature, oxidation reduction potential, dissolved oxygen, the flow, and in some cases, using field testing kits, such as HAC testing for alkalinity or sulfite. Now, performance can also be assessed by visual observations and laboratory analysis of parameters such as metals, sulfate, sulfide, and alkalinity. Visual observations include assessments of the water levels within each treatment component, accumulation of sludge, and integrity of the infrastructure such as liners, berms, and piping. In addition, monitoring for hydrogen sulfide can be a good indicator that the sulfate reduction is taking place, and it's also an important health and safety factor, given that in general, the hydrogen sulfide generated at the VCRs at an open air facility will not reach toxic levels, but at low-lying areas or manholes, this gas can be accumulated such that it could become a toxic gas. So other monitoring alone is important, given that it's a way of knowing that the VCRs are operating properly, but also create a nuisance to nearby residents. And in these cases, sometimes a small amount of hydrogen sulfide odor can be unacceptable to some of the neighbors or residents. Compliance monitoring includes not only parameters that can be readily measured in the field, but also parameters that need to be tested in the fixed laboratory, such as metals, biochemical oxygen demand, total suspended solids, ammonia, and sulfide. Now, the parameters can be analyzed by laboratory, but it really depends on the regulatory compliance requirement that each of these VCR systems have. Now, these parameters should be measured as often as possible in the influent to the reactor, at sampling ports, and at the effluent. Now, the slide number 78. Regarding performance monitoring, there are common parameters that need to be monitored in the field as well as in the laboratory. And we do the performance, as I mentioned before, in the influent to the VCR. This includes flow rate as well as water chemistry. At the VCR itself, we monitor the physical conditions of the system. This can also include substrate consumption or monitoring of the substrate consumption, and the chemistry at various locations and depths of the VCR. We also monitor the flow and water chemistry at the VCR effluent. Now, regarding field parameters, essentially in the guidance they are broken down into common and optional field parameters. Now, the common parameters include flow rate, temperature, pH, oxidation reduction potential, dissolved oxygen, visual observations, as well as hydrogen sulfide. Now, in addition to those parameters, there are other parameters that are considered optional, one of them being the iron speciation, which can measure with some field testing sometimes how iron is distributed in the system with regards to the state of oxidation from ferrous or Fe2, or ferric, oxidized form of iron, Fe3. And that also would allow you to understand whether or not the VCR is operating appropriately. In addition, acidity can be measured in the field, alkalinity, sulfide, and sulfate. Now, sulfate, for instance, you track the rate and level of sulfate reduction in the VCR. So good sulfate reduction can be an indicator of a healthy sulfate-reducing bacteria environment, and can be used to determine if enough sulfite stoichiometrically is being produced to precipitate metals. Now moving on to laboratory parameters. This slide covers the common commercial laboratory parameters, but one should know that some of these parameters can actually be measured in the field when if you have the appropriate field test kit. Now, metals can include, as Paul mentioned before, aluminum, iron, arsenic, cadmium, copper, chromium, lead, manganese, selenium, and zinc. There are other metals that may be of interest to the particular site, or they may be regulated at the effluent that need to be monitored. Now, they are measured in the influent and effluent to determine the removal efficiencies of the systems and also for compliance demonstration. Now, high levels of iron and aluminum can increase the clogging potential for VCRs and are often monitored closely when present. Sulfate, sulfide, and alkalinity were described before, but in general, there is a preference to, in addition of testing in the field, to corroborate the analytical data with commercial laboratory results. Biochemical oxygen demand is used as an indicator of the readily available organic concentration in the system, and this parameter is used to ensure sufficient food source and may also be regulated in the effluent. Total dissolved solids and total suspended solids may be regulated to protect the receiving water. TSS and TDS are not intended to be treated by VCRs, but some removal takes place. Now, ammonia, nitrate, nitride, and phosphorus are all potentially regulated parameters, and these parameters may be present in the VCR and in the effluent of the VCRs. Now, monitoring for substrate use, if there are appropriate sampling locations during the construction of the VCRs, sometimes pre-placed packets or cores of the substrate can be assessed to determine how much unreacted solid substrate remains in the system. These cores or packets can be observed visually, and a laboratory assessment can also be done to calculate the loss of a substrate. Moving on to compliance monitoring. In general, VCRs will discharge effluent to surface water rather than groundwater. Surface water discharges to streams, wetlands, lakes, and oceans are typically regulated by the Clean Water Act of 1972. In some cases, by state or tribe equivalents as well. Now, in most cases, active mine sites must also comply with provisions of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act for coal mining and hard rock mining, and secure a permit for discharge to surface water under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES. Now, abandoned mine sites fall under other regulatory purview, such as CERCLA or RECRA, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, sometimes brownfields, state and local or tribal programs. Now, with respect to the frequency of sampling for compliance, it also varies based on location, the goals of treatment, the variability of influent flows and concentrations. In some cases, the access to the site determines how frequent somebody can go and do monitoring. So the required compliance monitoring parameters will vary based on the regulatory framework. The previous slide discussed several parameters that may be potentially regulated as part of the sampling program. Moving on to sample collection. Sample collection procedures should follow site-specific plans when available. Now, if those are not available, then best sampling collection practices to maintain sample quality as well as being able to meet the compliance requirements. In some instances, site-specific sampling and analysis plans and data quality assurance plans are developed or necessary to validate the field and laboratory data. Nevertheless, consistent field protocols, including flow monitoring and sample collection, should be implemented. Sampling protocols that outline the planning, execution, and documentation of sampling and field events are strongly encouraged, especially those activities that are instituted for demonstrating compliance with applicable local, state, or federal requirements. Now, there are prescribed methods for manual sampling. This should be followed as well. Some of them are actually called by regulation, and others are provided by the manufacturers of the various field test meters or chemistry kits. Now, regarding sample types, we can have graph samples, composite samples, or incremental samples, depending on the site requirements and goals of the sampling. Now, graph samples are a single sample collected over a very short period of time, normally within 15 minutes. Composite samples can be time-based or flow-based composites, and this can be collected over a time period that can be a 12-hour, 24-hour, sometimes a two-day, depending on how the regulatory framework is set up. Moving on to sample analysis, slide number 83. The sample analysis protocols will be essentially site-specific. The ITRC-VCR guidance contains summary tables that show the specific field parameters in table 6.2 and laboratory parameters in table 6.3, as well as the samples management, including packaging, preservation, and transportation. Now, in addition, some quality assurance, quality control measures are also presented in the ITRC guidance. Moving on to flow measuring devices. There are multiple devices and methods used for flow measurement. Details of some of these methods are included in one of the guidance appendices. A few examples include open channel flumes, B-notch weirs, and Marsh-McBurney calculation of open stream flow, and even using a stopwatch and a bucket to measure flow in streams. In this slide, we have an example of a triangular B-notch weir on the right-hand side at the bottom. and a trapezoidal flume at the top. To the left, there is an individual actually collecting measurements of water depth and velocity across the stream to determine the flow of the open stream through the use of the Marsh-McBurney flow measurement protocol. Now, moving on to operations of VCRs. In general, as I mentioned before, passively designed VCRs can run by themselves, but may require some on-site operation and maintenance on a seasonal basis, such as opening and closing valves, exercising valves when available, or modifying flow control structures to influence the flow patterns in the VCRs. Periodic inspection of the physical condition of the treatment systems should be conducted. Monitoring the physical condition of the system generally includes visual inspection of the overall system and surroundings, including various components of the pre- and post-treatments when these are available. We should look at the changes from a normal operation and track these changes that may occur slowly over a time period in order to identify and mitigate minor problems before they cause major system upsets. So regular inspections should include monitoring the flow through the system, the integrity of the system as well, valves, and if applicable, electrical and mechanical equipment, which is they're not as common. Now, it's important to maintain a uniform flow through the VCRs and identify if preferential flow or clogging is actually taking place by areas that are shown that dry out or become stagnant. Either of these situations will impact the treatment performance because of the loss of treatment area or volume. Now, the following are should be included as part of the monitoring of the system. Monitoring the hydraulic head with piezometers, gauges, and standpipes, and other features designed to determine the inflow and effluent of the treatment units. Check the operation of gravity units, inspect the drop inlets and outlets and weirs, look for clogging and or water backing up. Moving on to substrate maintenance. We look at the substrate viability with respect to chemistry. We do some substrate testing, which involves essentially monitoring the ORP across the bed of the VCRs and having physical collection of cores. Now, to estimate the time for substrate changeout, the substrate should be sampled normally after 6 months or after 1 year after steady-state operation. It's recommended that the VCR be resampled at an estimated half life of the substrate to evaluate the reaction progress. The slide on the bottom left shows a configuration for the sampling ports that are nested wells at various depths so that the ORP can be measured at different depths, and based on that determine in general how the front of the ORP is going through the VCR. On the right-hand side, you see an example of the cross-section of the substrate where you the various zones of the core are identified. On the top, you have the oxide zone, followed by the transitional zone, the sulfide area, and relatively fresh substrate at the bottom. Now, slide number 87. the guidance includes a section on troubleshooting, and essentially it splits this section into two types of troubleshooting, the chemical trends troubleshooting as well as the physical trends. Some examples of troubleshooting include observing the sulfate. Now, the difference between the source water and reactant unit sulfate concentrations will indicate if sulfate reduction is actually taking place. If you have pretty much the same concentration coming in as coming out, then obviously the sulfate-reducing bacteria is not doing its job. The lower ORP values in the biochemical reactor unit will indicate if oxygen has been removed and conditions are suitable for sulfate reduction. pH is also used to monitor the performance. An increase in pH from the source water may indicate the commencement of a sulfate reduction, which produces alkalinity. Now, sulfide, as indicated before, the lack of the presence of sulfide odor in the VCR effluent can be an indication that the VCR may not be performing as designed. Additionally, field assays for sulfide performing by an experienced field technician can be used to supplement or replace sulfate measurements to determine if sulfate reduction is taking place. Now, with respect to physical trends, some of the examples include plugging, whether visually present at valves or based on overflow conditions, overflow and flow controls, short-circuiting, in some cases gas locks up in the VCRs. The structural of integrity of berms or dike ponds or liners are compromised, or erosion of system components and stormwater management are also included. Now, this slide concludes the monitoring, operation, and maintenance section of the designing and implementing a VCR. Now, this section, as I mentioned before, is based on Chapter 6 of the guidance, and I now would like to hand over the presentation to Chris Brown from the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Let me move on to the slide. Oh, that wasn't it. Okay. I will be discussing challenges and solutions to implementing VCRs. Oops, that's not it. Where's the next slide?
It's on the bottom left.
Bottom left. Okay, got it. Okay, there are, thank you, got it. There are several challenges and solutions to implementing VCRs, and these include technical, regulatory, and stakeholder challenges. The technical challenges we've already discussed, but so I will be discussing the regulatory and stakeholder challenges. Regulatory challenges include permitting, water quality standards, disposal of residual materials, i.e. the substrate, and wetlands. Stakeholder challenges include things like community and tribal concerns, liability, and use of mining-influenced water as a resource. Moving on to slide 91, permitting requirements will vary depending on the location and also the project phase. They will vary across states, localities, and tribal regions also. Types of permits that may be required include land disturbance and erosion and stormwater control permits to discharge permits for active mining operations, since local and tribal and state and federal regulations vary from site to site. It's important to consult with the all agencies, permitting agencies involved, to ensure that the appropriate permitting requirements are satisfied. Moving on to slide 92, water quality standards are another important measurement, are another important regulatory consideration. They're usually set to either aquatic health to ensure aquatic health or human health. And while DCRs can generally meet pH standards, they may not always meet the stringent chronic toxicity standards for metals. And this is because DCRs rely on natural processes to for their operation, and so sometimes they may not be able to meet the low chronic toxicity standards for metals. So this is something that needs to be understood by all parties involved in, and it's important to consider what are the cleanup standards for the particular project when considering, and then decide if the DCR is going to be able to meet those standards. Residuals and wetlands are another important regulatory consideration, in that the spent substrate has high concentrations of metals, and so every so often it's one may need to replace the substrate, and when doing so, one needs to consider the disposal of the substrate, how to dispose of the residual substrate. And since there are high concentrations of metals, it may need to be tested and disposed of as hazardous waste. Alternatively, there may be some use for some way to recycle the metals in the substrate. So wetlands are another important regulatory challenge, in that there are federal, state, and local laws that may apply to high-quality wetlands located in coastal areas or in freshwater. And oftentimes biochemical reactors may, when implementing the biochemical reactor, it may either create wetlands or destroy wetlands. And if it destroys wetlands, there may be local regulatory laws that apply to that. And in some cases, DCRs can create unintended wetlands. And an example of this is shown in the photo for the Galinsky Biochemical Reactor in Northern California. And creation of unintentional wetlands created by DCRs may influence the performance of the wetland, influence the performance of the DCR. So for further information on wetlands, ITRC has two guidance documents that are listed here in the slide. And so, these resources can be used to get further information on wetlands. Moving on to slide 94, stakeholder concerns are also very important, and there are several stakeholder concerns, several different stakeholder groups that are very important. Communities are one group of stakeholders in that not all BCRs are located in remote locations. Some of them may be located direct, near residential areas. And there are several concerns to communities. For example, the construction of the wetland may create additional noise and additional traffic. And people also may need to access the site to sample or maintain the BCR during operation. BCRs can also be an attractive nuisance to curious children and wildlife. In addition, as mentioned earlier, hydrogen sulfide is a gas that may be produced as a result of the natural operations of the BCR. So odors may be a problem. So it's important to have a good public outreach program at all stages of the BCR implementation to make sure that the community understands the aspects of the BCR and so that the regulatory agencies can address community concerns. Moving on to slide 95, tribal concerns and volunteer groups are two other important groups of stakeholders. Many, most Native American tribes have a different perception of environmental protection and remediation than Western societies. These tribes have, some tribes have established environmental departments, and EPA has actually delegated regulatory authority to some of the tribes, and these tribes have developed water, enforceable water quality standards. So to ensure, so it's important to communicate with local tribal contacts as well as EPA tribal liaisons when dealing with BCRs that are located near or on tribal land. Volunteer groups are another important stakeholder group. In some areas of the country, the mining influence water is the result of unregulated mining activities of the past. And in some cases, local volunteer groups want to initiate projects to try to improve the water quality of these unregulated mines. And however, there's no responsible party to pay for the cleanup. So the volunteer group will try and gather together the necessary resources, technical and financial, to pay for cleanup. However, some of these groups may need assistance with respect to navigating the process, dealing with local authorities, technical resources to design and operate the BCR, and they may have limits of groups may have limited funding and resources, and they may not be able to meet all regulatory requirements. So faced with requirements that they can't meet, sometimes the groups may not be able to implement a cleanup project. And as a result, projects that could result in environmental improvement may not end up being done. And liability is an important concern to volunteer groups, and I'll be discussing that in the next slide. Moving on to slide 96, as I said, liability is an important aspect of any cleanup that's being undertaken by a volunteer group, in that if a volunteer group will start to implement a project, they face the possibility that they may become liable for all regulatory requirements for cleanup, even if the scope is beyond the resources of the local group. And so this limits, this has limited the ability of local watershed groups to actually clean up sites. So what's been known as Good Samaritan laws have been developed in several states. And for example, in Pennsylvania, they enacted the Good Samaritan Act in 1999. And this, they've got a really strong program to help local watershed groups clean up abandoned mine sites in Pennsylvania. Additionally, US EPA has also developed the Good Samaritan Initiative that applies to hard rock mining sites. And it was initiated on December 12, 2012, a model comfort letter and a model settlement agreement has been developed as well. However, some people think that the US EPA has not gone far enough to with their efforts, and there are many states that do not have Good Samaritan laws. So this is remains a significant concern for local watershed groups that would like to clean up mining sites. The quote at the bottom of the slide, which says the perfect should not be the enemy of the good, refers to the fact that projects that could result in environmental improvement may not wind up being done because due to liability or regulatory issues. Moving on to slide 97, mining influenced water can also be is also being considered for use as an emerging resource, and there are a couple operations that are under consideration. For example, the gas industry is considering using mining influenced water for hydrofracking. And to that end, again, Pennsylvania has developed a white paper outlining the process for reuse of mining influenced water in hydrofracking. Additionally, some eastern coalfield watershed groups have begun to use mining influenced water to operate generators to produce electricity. And use of mining-influenced water as an emerging resource faces many of the same challenges as the cleanup of mining-influenced water. Discharge water quality and potential liability for perpetual cleanup are two important issues that need to be considered for potential reuse of mining-influenced water. And now I'd like to turn the presentation back over to Sherry for a wrap-up of today's training.
Okay, thank you, Christine. I would just like to wrap up today's training by reminding you what our key the key takeaway messages are. And first and foremost is that biochemical reactors are viable alternatives for treating mining-influenced water, especially in when you have mining-influenced water in remote areas. Biochemical reactors are site-specific, meaning that you're going to be designing your biochemical reactor to fit your particular site in your particular location with your particular contaminants. So it's not a one-size-fits-all type technology. And that they're not walk-away systems, although they may be low maintenance and they may be low monitoring. They don't need a whole lot of work, but they aren't walk-away systems. So you can't just put it in and walk away. But they do work. They do remove metals. They do remove sulfides from mining-influenced water or other types of waste streams that have those contaminants. And finally, the web-based ITRC document on biochemical reactors is a convenient resource for you to use when considering and implementing a biochemical reactor. Now I'd like to thank you for your time and for your attention and turn it back to Juliana for questions.
Thank you. We are going to have a couple of minutes for questions. Before we get to those, I do want to point our links to additional resources from this page. If you follow the link here in that second bullet, you can download the PowerPoint presentation that you've seen during today's class. There's additional information in the notes section of the downloaded version. You can also access the document that's the basis of today's training. Also, our feedback form. We have a new feature that we've just started this month, and that's going to allow you to create a certificate for your attendance today. So you do need to complete the feedback form. There's a checkbox at the bottom. You do need to check that checkbox. I don't have any other way of getting you a certificate. You need to fill out the feedback form and check the box in order to get a certificate of participation. You're welcome to send in questions using the Q&A box in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to jump in. It's #6 to unmute, and you can jump in with a question. We have a question about troubleshooting. Is there a way to design a BCR to avoid gas locking issues?
Juliana, this is Eduardo. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, in general, they're actually designed to avoid the generation of gas. And when that's, it does generate, it should be in normally taken care of during the design. However, there are instances where pockets of hydrogen sulfide gas get generated, and a lot of it has to do with the loading to the VCRs. Normally, you want to design in such a way that the sulfate coming to the VCRs is much lower than the capacity of the VCR to handle the generation of sulfide, such that sulfide reacts with the metals and other cations, minimizing the production of gas.
Do you ever use horizontal augers for substrate mixing?
Is Paul on the line?
I am. I'm not aware of anyone trying that. There have been some systems in Pennsylvania where they've kind of gone in and they just basically just kind of mix it vertically. They've actually just kind of used a small excavator. And that was a system that was designed. It was an old system. Again, it was primarily mushroom compost. And you know, it worked well for a fair number of years, and then they did have some plugging problems and some permeability issues and went in and just kind of remixed everything. That helped for, again, extended the life, but eventually they had to replace it and went with kind of a wood chip and spent mushroom compost mixture, again, to provide better permeability and hope to avoid those kind of plugging problems. But I've never heard anyone using any kind of horizontal augers to do them. Since usually, I guess, you know, if you had a horizontal, I don't know, it's usually just, I'm not sure what circumstance you'd want to do that either. I'm thinking most of the systems you probably just want to mix it in a vertical manner rather than a horizontal manner. But if I'm missing something, again, you know, feel free to follow up. That didn't answer your question.
How are oxyanions removed or reduced in concentration? Are oxyanions converted or reduced to less toxic form by bacteria? For example, would selenate be reduced to organoselenium or selenite?
So it depends. Again, it always depends. But selenium is a good one to talk about. So selenium is removed, and selenium is actually removed very effectively in a biochemical reactor. And you know, the common form in surface waters in oxygen surface is selenate, and that essentially is reduced in the BCR, and primarily, we believe it's reduced to elemental selenium. There are some organoselenium compounds also formed, but you know, primarily the end goal is to actually get it into the elemental form. And again, it is very effective. There's been a lot of work on it. I have some friends who have systems in West Virginia. They're removing, it's in relatively low inputs, 20 to 30 micrograms per liter, but they have to get down to 5, so very tight standards for selenium. We've actually used it in other systems where we have much higher selenium and got pretty good removal, but not all the way down to 5. So have to look at the pathologies there. So again, it depends on the specific anion. Chromium, that comes in as primarily chromate, and that is reduced to chromium 3 and then removed in the PCR as well.
Thank you. We are out of time. If you've sent in a question that you would like addressed, please email that to training@itrcweb.org. You can respond to your reminder emails or your confirmation email, and let us know that you have a question, and we will post that for the trainers to follow up after today's training class. We'll go ahead and wrap up today's class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information, and we appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.